All right, today we talked to Justin Kraft. Now, Justin is a very, very dear friend of mine. And so we talked about his story from when he was a kid moving to Texas, and then he moved back to Alabama, and how growing up as an athlete and what he wanted to be when he grew up. The three very, very influential guys in his life that really totally changed the trajectory of his life in so many ways. How he started out and won a contest in college and got given $10,000 to go make that dream happen. And then when that dream, not failed, but didn't do really well, what he transitioned into and the power of relationships, and how the relationship of a guy named Gene Bartow put him on a trajectory that has helped him change hundreds or really thousands of people's lives, and the difference he's making in the financial industry, but also in the kingdom of God, and how his love for Jesus and how he wants to tell people about how Jesus can save you, but also how important your relationship is with Jesus in your financial and business life. You're going to absolutely love this episode with Justin Kraft. Justin, thanks for joining me today.
Good to be with you, man.
Awesome. So one of the things that's hard about this sometimes is when I have guests on here and I know them,
yeah,
it's hard to ask questions because I know the answers to a lot of questions. Okay, but I always learn a lot, even no matter who it is. And so this is Justin. Justin's a great friend of mine. In the last probably year or two, he's been a mentor of mine, just kind of helping me through different things. And I really appreciate him for what he's done just in my life from a practical standpoint, from a financial standpoint, from a spiritual standpoint, as much as anything. And so having him on here today is going to help me dive deep into my world of someone that I love, respect, and care for, but also value tremendously. And so this is a little bit of a dive deep into one of the people that's in the circle that knows a lot about me. So just getting started, just the high level stuff. Who are you? What do you do? And why does what you do matter?
Yeah. Deep question.
Start off big.
I see. Well, first of all, I'm pumped about being here with you. I love the idea of this show. The title, The Owner's Table. Mm-hmm. I mean, this life, when people ask me about creating wealth, which you ask, mm-hmm. Hey, what do you do?
Yeah.
That's my day job is we have a financial advising firm, Nowlin, Nowlin.
Yep, that's right.
Nowlin Wealth Management. We've been, in fact, this year in March is going to be 50 years that our firm has been in Birmingham.
So let's make sure we understand. Justin is not 75 years old. So.
I
feel like it sometimes. Yeah. But we're going to get to that in a minute. So you help people create wealth.
That's what we want to do. We want to partner with people to give them a path to get from where they are to mm-hmm. where they want to be the most efficient and effective way possible. Sometimes that's creating wealth. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's maintaining wealth. And then hopefully the whole idea is to grow wealth.
I heard somebody say one time, and tell me what you think about this this question, this thought is, it's really, really easy to make money.
Sure.
It's extremely hard to manage money.
I think it's like anything, Thomas. Mm-hmm. We all have gifts. We all have talents. And I have noticed over the years, I've been doing it 25 years. Yeah. So I've noticed over the years that it comes easier for some than others. But here's what I will tell you. There's one common theme above on the whole thing, and that is ownership leads to creating wealth. Whether you're owning real estate, whether you're owning businesses, whether you're owning instruments that allow you to grow that and protect that wealth, ownership is what leads to wealth. And if we can teach people how to think like owners, then the process will fall into place and they'll move closer to those goals.
So it's not necessarily being a business owner. It's having a thought and a mindset. And I kind of hate the word mindset, but it's because it's really buzzword right now. But having a mindset of, I'm going to own whatever it is I'm doing.
Yeah, 100%. So it is, and you say mindset, and I know people talk a lot about it, but honestly, where does it begin?
Sure.
How do you think? And I, you know, so many people hear this, but there is a big difference between an abundant mindset and a scarcity mindset.
Very much so.
And I challenge people on a daily basis not to think fearfully. Be smart, have a strategy, have a plan, have the right partnerships, but think abundantly. And when you think abundantly, then it leads to ownership.
It does. I totally agree. So let's go back. So we know what you do now. Yep. Let's go back to childhood. Let's just take it way back. Okay, so tell me about growing up, where you grew up.
Yeah.
The home that you grew up in, your folks.
Yeah.
So give me some background there about who you are, who Justin Kraft really is.
Yeah, man. So started out, I was born in Lafette, Alabama.
Okay.
A thriving metropolis in East Alabama.
Exactly.
About 2,000 people.
Not many people at all.
Yep. When I was 5 years old, my dad had an opportunity to take over managing a trucking operation in the oil and gas business that was based in East Texas. So when I was 5 years old, we uprooted. We moved to East Texas.
I did not know that. Yeah. See, we are 4 minutes into this thing, and there's something I didn't know about Justin.
I had to save a couple of surprises.
You saved something. Okay. So at five, moved to East Texas.
Yep.
So your dad was a business owner. Was he a business owner? More?
No. I mean,
so he worked for this company?
He was an operational guy.
Okay.
Yeah. So he worked for a trucking company.
Yeah.
In the operational division. So we were there when I was 14. Parents went through a divorce, and I moved back to Alabama, and that's how I got to Alexander City, Lake Martin.
So 9 years in East Texas.
Yeah, 9 years. Still have some great friends that I went through junior high with.
Growing up, what was the home like growing up? Your dad, did he work a lot? What'd your mom do? Yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I got a great mom. She's mm-hmm. my hero, is Thomas. She was both a mom and a dad to me. Mm. My dad was gone a lot,
sure.
And then ended up leading to a single parent home, and which is part of the reason I got into the financial industry. But you know, she was a driving force. She was a lady of strong faith, and she taught me a lot of lessons that I'll never forget. One of the biggest ones that I am thankful for today is you never quit.
Mm.
Never quit.
Yeah.
Finish what you start, never quit. When you get to the end of it, you can reevaluate.
Exactly.
But never give up, never quit. And I saw her live that each and every day in her faith, in her journey through life. She got dealt a lot of curveballs.
Yeah.
And as the youngest son watching that, it had a big impact on me.
Did she work outside the home? Did she work in the home?
Yeah, she never did until once the divorce was final. She ended up working two, sometimes three jobs.
Wow.
Thomas, when I was in high school. To make ends meet, we had a good middle class childhood,
sure.
And then after that, things got pretty hard, and taught me a lot of lessons again, and I'm thankful for those days.
So you've talked about faith a couple times here in the first four or five minutes. Was church a big part of growing up? Was that something that you guys did every week? I mean, like for us, my mom was. You know, played the organ in the Baptist church 9 months before I was born, and she's 75, and she still plays it today.
Yeah.
So I was in church Monday, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Like, that's all I remember. What about you? What about you?
Yeah, man, if I'm honest with you, it was off and on.
Sure.
So as a young kid, obviously we were in church on Sundays.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember much of that, to be honest with you. It was more just what you did.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, had a pretty unique experience with my Savior when I was about 8 years old. And
okay.
I remember being in the church and all of a sudden having a desire to talk and tell the people of the congregation who Jesus was to me.
Wow.
And went to our pastor, and thankfully he said, I think this is something we need to do. So they gave me a lot of notes, and I can't really remember it.
Yeah.
All that I heard is every note that I was given is not what I talked about that day.
Nice.
I was able to get up in front of a church at 8 years old and mm-hmm. tell them about the love of Jesus. And I think about that today because, Thomas, as an adult, if I'm honest, going through college, God was always a part of my life.
Yeah.
My faith was important. It was important in the business decisions that
right.
I made when I got out of college. But the relationship with him changed for me in 2017.
Mm.
And I walked through a couple of difficult things that happened at one time in life, and it brought me closer to him. And that's when the relationship really started. That's when the morning routine kicked in.
Mm.
That's when the church really began to matter to me, and it wasn't just checking a box on Sunday. It really began to matter, and I'm so thankful for that, man.
Man, oh man, that's awesome. So at 14, you guys moved back to moved to Alex City.
Yeah.
Tell me about, that's middle school, late middle school, early high school. Tell me about life then. Mom, single mom working multiple jobs.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Blessed to have a great family. I got an older brother that had a tire and service center in Alexander City.
Okay.
That's why we chose to go back there to be around family. And Thomas Sports was my life. So
got another athlete on here.
Well, that's a loose term, but not as good as you, man. But I got involved playing football, playing baseball, mm-hmm. basketball, ran track. If it had a ball, I was playing it. Right. Played a little tennis, believe
there
it or
you
not.
Go.
Never practiced. Never just showed practiced, up at the
just,
matches.
That's it.
But I think it was a huge part of my life because it taught me so many lessons about being on a team and about hard work, about overcoming adversity. Mm. And I'm really, really thankful. But that's what that high school life was like. It was always in the gym.
Always a place to go.
Always a place to go, something to do.
Practice to be at, a game to go to, all
yep.
that.
Yep.
So when you were in middle school and high school, when someone would come up to you and say, "Hey, Justin, what do you want to be when you grow up?"
Mm-hmm.
What would you say at that time? What were you saying at that time?
Yeah, so I said what everybody said. I'm going to go to the NFL.
Nice.
And then I said after that, I'm going to be a business owner. I always enjoyed having been around my dad early and seeing the business world. When we used to play games as kids, some of my old – I've got a couple of childhood friends that I still talk to.
Yeah.
And they remember when we would go out in the field, you always said, "Hey, let's play a game and we'll be a business owner." And you were always telling us what to do. They laugh about that.
Really?
We would pretend to have businesses set up. And I remember those days. It's hilarious to talk about it. But that was something I always wanted. Then seeing my older brother, he owned a tire and service center.
Yeah.
And working there, it was just something that I enjoyed. I like numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It's always kind of made sense to me.
Okay.
So that was after the NFL, which didn't happen, by the
right.
way.
Don't ruin the story. So in high school, you're playing multiple sports. You're at Benjamin Russell High School. Did you go to Benjamin Russell?
Mm-hmm.
Benjamin Russell High School. Go to college. Talk about the transition from high school to college and what that looked like.
Yeah. It was interesting. So, Thomas, I was being recruited, honestly, I was a tweener. I didn't know it at the time, but I was getting – I had Vanderbilt. I had a couple of the academies.
Always good at grades?
And good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not you know,
high test score guy?
I was pretty high on the tests, and I had a 3-2, 3-3 in high school, something like that.
Three
so
two.
So
three-two guy.
I should have done better, but you know, I was able to get by. And ended up, Georgia Tech had been recruiting me, mm-hmm. recruiting me, taking visits up there. Took some visits to a couple of SEC schools and never got the offers. And Georgia Tech was about 2 years off a national championship. I loved That's the right. culture. It blew me away.
Now, who was the head coach at the time?
Bobby Ross.
Bobby. Gotcha.
Yeah, Bobby Ross.
Okay.
Some fantastic. Yeah. His coaching tree is wide
it
and
is.
Deep.
Yeah.
So ended up going to play for Georgia Tech.
Okay.
And it was fantastic, man. Still have some good friends to this day.
Yeah.
A night game at Bobby Dodd Stadium
it's
is
awesome.
Like nothing you can imagine.
I love it there.
But 2 years into that, we had a coaching change. And I got moved from safety, where I was running second team as a redshirt freshman behind a senior, feeling really good about things. My position coach was gone, new defensive coordinator, new head coach.
Who was the new head coach?
So Bill Lewis came in.
Okay.
Bill Lewis had been at Georgia as a defensive coordinator, went to East Carolina, had one good year. They went undefeated, had Jeff Blake as a quarterback. Then he got hired at Georgia Tech, and unfortunately, things didn't go well.
Yeah.
20 guys in my class ended up transferring out.
20?
20, yeah.
And this was in 1995?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it had been 94, 95 year that all the transfers were taking place.
20 guys?
Yeah.
They just came in and just cut. So people don't know this. Scholarships in college football, scholarships are not four-year deals. They're one-year deals.
Yeah.
Now – they can cut whoever they want to cut, but typically they don't cut guys. Now, when new coaches come in, they have the full right to do that.
They didn't do a lot of cutting. They did some. This was a culture, I'll be honest with you. After he was there a year, the culture really, really changed, unfortunately, and in the program. So I ended up –
So you didn't play for him at all?
I did. I played a season.
You did play a season?
Yeah.
For Bill Lewis?
Okay. I did. I played a season.
All right, so after that season, what happened?
After that season, a guy that lived next door to me, make a long story short, ended up transferring. He decided he was coming to UAB. He was an offensive lineman.
Who was that?
His name was Collins Peden. Mm. He was lineman of the year in Georgia. Big boy, 6'5", 315, played guard. So he ended up coming to UAB. I was actually talking to Sanford while he was there. I drove by. This is an amazing story. And when you talk about the hand of our Father above years later – so I stopped by to see him. as I'm there, he takes me over to the office. I meet Gene Bartow. Gene Bartow begins to tell me about what UAB is going to do. They're starting moving up to Division I in football. Yeah. They're going to be hiring a new coach, which became Watson Brown.
Yeah.
And he was recruiting me. He said, it sounds like you're looking around. You should come here. And he said one thing to me that I have never forgotten, Thomas. Wow. He said, wherever you go, you're going to be a part of a great history. He said, but if you come to UAB in Birmingham, you'll make history.
I'm
20 years old, and I'm like,
that's where I'm going. I got to run to the wall.
This is it. This is where I'm coming.
Some of you people don't know, Gene Bartow worked for Coach Wooden at UCLA, was one of his major assistant he had for years and years and years.
Yep.
Gene comes to Birmingham and starts athletics. Correct me if I start straight off. Starts athletics at UAB,
correct,
pretty much.
He's the grandfather.
He is the grandfather. It's Bartow Arena. And so he comes here, extremely successful basketball program.
Yep.
And it's here, I don't know how many years, and then they start football. They want to say they start football in the mid-90s, and then they hire Watson Brown in 1995.
Yep.
And he comes in as the head coach.
Sure.
So you transfer here. So you transfer before Watson gets here.
Yep, I transfer before Watson gets here.
Okay.
But when he was announced, I was elated because he was the OC at Mississippi State and had recruited me. He had gone to Oklahoma for a year and then came back.
Did you have any interaction with Watson in the recruiting process?
Uh-huh.
You did?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So you come to UAB. What from there?
Yeah, came to UAB. They brought in the new staff, a man that is – unbelievably important in my life to this very day. I talked to him last week. Got announced as the defensive backs coach. I was playing secondary. His name was John Neal. And that man taught me so much about football, but much, much more about life, which leads to my story later on. And he was a man of faith, and he was not afraid to let you know, which was uncommon on the football field at the time. And
John
just
Neal,
a great guy.
John Neal is – just like for you, John Neal is incredibly important for me. So I didn't realize this until the back end of – until after I'd gotten out of school. So a guy named Larry Crow was the guy that, quote, recruited my school. And but John had been in so many places and coached so many good – John held a lot of weight on that staff for Watson. And John Neal's son, Casey, played at Pelham. And so the year that I came out, a guy named Tyler Watts. Tyler was incredible. Tyler, in my opinion, was a lot better than I was. But Tyler and I played against each other my junior year. Mm-hmm. And we played against Pelham. I played well. He played well. But John Neal tells a story of them going, him going and watching that game. It happened to be a game that he could go to. Because, you know, college football coaches can't go to a bunch of games. And we played them. And he said, I walked back in the room the next day, and he said, Tyler Watts is a good football player, but the kid we want to get is Thomas Cox at Hueytown. And I did not know that story until after I was gone. And so John Neal was incredibly valuable to me being at UAB. And I've kept in touch with him after he left. He went to Oregon for numerous years. He's come back to Birmingham. I mean, but he is an incredible human being in my life, in your life. And I just can't – I can't say enough good things about the guy.
Yeah.
So
unbelievably influential in so many people's lives. And that just, you know, that tells you a lot about the difference. John Maxwell talks about success versus significance. Mm-hmm. And that is a man that never worried about his own success, but he was so significant to so many people that were around him.
So many people.
Yeah.
So many people. All right, so you're at UAB. Hire Watson. Hire John.
Yeah.
Tell me about the rest of your time playing ball.
Man, greatest experience of my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had some ups and downs, learned to appreciate, didn't quite have the winning that we thought we would have. I played on some tremendous defenses.
You did.
Yeah. If we had had Thomas Cox at quarterback, we might have won a few more games. But we had some tremendous defenses. I think we were second in the NCAA in turnovers one year. We were top 15 in total defense my senior year. Played some great programs.
You did.
My goal was always to play at Jordan-Hare. I grew up close and got the chance to go play there. Had 8 tackles, which was a dream come true.
That's
man.
Incredible.
It was awesome. And Brian Bozeman took away my interception. I tell him that every day. He tipped a ball that was coming right to me. That would have been a great, great memory. But I had to throw that in there.
That's right.
But, man, just some tremendous experiences.
Sure.
Really enjoyed it so much. And, you know, 2 or 3 of the guys that stood up beside me in my wedding – were on those teams that I played with. And the best thing that came from that was my wife, Kim. Mm-hmm. Kim and I met my junior year at UAB and began to date. We ended up getting married after graduation, and no doubt the best decision that I ever made. But she's a Birmingham girl.
She's wonderful. So you touched on something that I want to dive into a little bit. So talk about the value in teams and what that does, and the relationships that you can create from being on a team. Because you talked about numerous guys in your wedding.
Yeah.
There's 6 or 8 guys, maybe 10 guys at the very most, in your wedding. And you're saying probably close to half of them you played with.
Yeah.
Why? How does that happen? Why is that so important, you think?
You know, there's so many directions I could go with that. Mm-hmm. But just at a high level, trust.
Sure. Oh, man.
Trust, man. Yeah. Over time, those are the guys that you're in battle with every day, and you see the character of who they are. Mm-hmm. When times are hard, you see who steps up. When you're in a January workout at 6 a.m., mm-hmm. you see who's putting in the effort and who's trying to halfway do it. And over time, you don't recognize it at the time, but over time, that builds trust because you know the character of that guy beside you.
I totally agree. Yeah. That is so good. So as you're in college, you were at Georgia Tech, you transfer to UAB, you're playing, you're meeting some incredible people, probably like you said, one of the best experiences of your life. At this point, where are you? What are you thinking? Because you somewhat have a realization that, you know what, the NFL may not work out.
Yeah.
What's next? At this point, what are you still thinking you're wanting to go do for a living?
Yeah, 100% in college. I really, really began to see that I wanted to be in the business world. I didn't understand where, how.
Yeah,
but I knew that was where I wanted to be. And in my junior and senior year, I really began to take classes that were marketing driven, but they ended up being more, and this is supposedly a bad word, but I promise you, if you understand it, everybody does it. I really began to see that I like sales. I like to communicate, and everybody in every business is selling.
Everybody.
To your listeners out there, I don't care what you're doing. You're selling yourself. And you're selling your business every day to that potential customer that's going to come in, whether you're in a product business, a service business. And so sales, honestly, is nothing more than establishing and building relationships and building trust, whether it's short-term in a transaction or whether it's long-term in a partnership. Sales is all about building trust. And I tell everybody out there, when I'm meeting with people and we're working, I tell them, be sure you're focusing every day on the skill of asking questions, building relationships, and building trust. Because if you want to be an owner, like on the owner's table, you've got to be able to build relationships and sell.
Mm. So when you're at UAB, you end up leaving UAB, graduating.
Yep.
What's the first step after college? After you, the NFL's not there. I think did you go to a camp?
Yeah. So, I'll back up a second. My last class at UAB, we actually had to come up with a business plan.
Okay.
I wish I could remember the name of the class, but it was one. We had to come up with a business plan. Then we had to present our business plan to a panel. So I'm going to go back to Gene Bartow, that name.
Okay.
Gene Bartow was on the panel. There were a few professors and Gene Bartow and one outside alumni person. So my business was actually creating a magazine that covered UAB athletics. It was growing at the time, blowing up.
Sure.
Yeah, we had gone into Conference USA. Yep. So you had Louisville. You had all these big Cincinnati.
What year is this? 96, 97?
This is 96.
Okay.
Yeah, 96, 97.
Yeah.
So in 96, I go through and I make this presentation. I got lucky, and I ended up winning the contest with my business plan. After we're done, Gene Bartow came over to me and he said, "You put a plan together to cover UAB athletics. Do you think you could can you execute this? Can you put it together?" I said, "If I had a little money." So he said, "We're going to write you a $10,000 check as seed money. I want you to give this magazine to my top 1,000 donors and put this thing into works." So the Blaze magazine.
Do you remember that? Yes, I do. I've never heard this story.
Yeah, yep, absolutely.
So you started Blaze magazine.
I did. Yep, in college, 1996.
So Gene, and I don't think people really can conceptualize, because Gene's gone and passed away. I don't think people can really conceptualize the impact he had.
Oh,
not on UAB, but on Birmingham.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what he means to the city of Birmingham, because sports brings so many things together. It brings restaurants and hotels and community leaders, and it also brings people here.
Correct.
I can't tell you how many people are in this city because they played football, they played basketball, they played soccer, they played whatever.
Yeah.
And they're here and they stayed here.
Well, let me tell you what else it does. It builds pride in a school.
It does.
And therefore it has proven time and time again, it grows your undergraduate population. So for every student that comes to UAB, there was a study done in 2014, for every student that enrolls at UAB and stays a year, over time, for every 1,000 students, it has a $50 million economic impact in the greater city of Birmingham.
That's bonkers.
So athletics is the number one driver of that growth. Mm-hmm. It builds alumni pride. So if you look around and go downtown and you see all the apartments and you see the parks and you see the restaurants, all of that is because there's so much growth at UAB, and a part of that is due to the success of athletics and Absolutely. Gene Bartow's vision.
Oh, man. So you win this contest.
Yep.
Gene gives you 10 grand, says go do it.
Yep.
Tell me how that what went from there.
Yeah. Oh, man, I'd love to tell you it turned into this thriving business. So here's the first thing I did. If I'm going to own a business, I need a nice desk and a nice chair. So I go out and buy a nice desk and a nice chair, and that's not enough, because if I'm going to run a business, I got to have a nice computer. So I went out and bought a nice computer. That's important.
Very.
Yeah, absolutely. It's important.
No,
yeah.
Yeah.
So then I got to go get business cards that say president of the Blaze magazine, and I got to get stationery. So, Thomas, I blew about half of that.
Did you really?
In about the first week. Yeah. So then I had to go hire people. And it's funny, these people want to get paid when you hire.
Pretty quickly.
It's funny how that works. So I have to pay them in advance to get the production going, get things set up, and I've got to get a printer, and I've got to pay him in advance to buy the paper and buy the print materials. So real quick, I was broke, and I said, man, I need to go sell ads because this money's gone. So I hit the street, and I started selling ads to every pizza place around campus, anybody that was involved in the Alumni yeah. Association. And we got a business set up okay. and going. During this time, I was still trying out at football. I got yeah. one workout from the Cowboys. They said I was too short and too slow real quick. The Canadian League and the Arena League came calling. Go back to another name we mentioned. I went to John Neal. I said, yeah. Coach, I'm thinking about taking this offer in the CFL. He sat me down. He said, Justin, you got a degree in business. He said, you've already set up this newspaper. He said, don't be that guy that's chasing a dream. He said, you had a good college career. And I still remember this day, and you'll laugh because you'll appreciate it. Anybody out there that's ever played sports, when the realization that you'll never put on the pads again comes to you, and I had not had that until this point.
Yeah.
I was starting to see it, but just lying to myself.
Yeah.
That day, I said, Coach, can I play in the NFL? He said, Justin, there's 1,000 guys just like you.
Mm.
He said, so no. He said, you're not 6'3", you don't run a 4'4". He said, you're not going to play in the NFL.
It's
and
true.
And I went. I'm telling you the truth. I'm embarrassed to say this. I went home and cried. I cried like a baby, because I'm like, it's really over.
Right.
So, but he talked me into not chasing something
I didn't have a chance. Guys that you and I both know.
Yeah.
That would go from workout to workout to pay this and have four guys at a workout at a random field in the middle of nowhere and just.
Yep.
It's not. I say sad because you don't want to downplay someone's dream.
Yeah.
But a lot of those guys don't have a John Neal to speak positive,
yep.
truthful life into them.
Yep.
And I mean, we could go on just telling John Neal stories.
Yeah, we could.
So the Blaze is
so from there I focused on the magazine.
Okay.
After that day was over and after I cried in my pillow. So I focused on the magazine. I realized that, and I kept it. The Blaze magazine stayed in effect for about 5 years, but I realized it was not going to create right away what I wanted out of life. And so I had always enjoyed the stock market.
You did.
I was in an economics class. We played a stock market game that mm-hmm. I got real lucky and ended up winning in college as well.
Nice.
And it always stayed with me. And I had had a lot of potential job offers out of college. So I called one of those back from one of the really big firms that everyone had heard of, who, you know, the lion roars.
Oh, yeah.
And he's on the commercial. So I had verbally accepted that. But here again, I'm going back to relationships and
sure.
people. I was delivering some of the Blaze magazines on campus. I run into Coach Bartow again, and he said, "Justin, tell me what you're going to do now." And I said, "Coach, I'm getting in the financial business." He said, "Before you do that," he said, "call my guy. He's been here in town. I've worked with him for years. He's watched you play. Big UAB supporter. I think you'd love him. I need you to talk to him." By the time I got back to my apartment, and this tells you how old it was and how old I am, my answering machine light was blinking. Charlie Nallen gave me a call and said, "Coach said we need to meet." I went the next day, Thomas. We had a conversation like this where we didn't talk about finances. We just talked about he asked me about me for an hour and then told me a little bit about the career. And I just knew that day. I had a feeling. I said, "This is where I need to be." And I've been there ever since.
Wow.
25 years.
Again, Gene Bartow.
Yep.
Man, oh, man. Okay, so you go to work for Charlie. I've met Charlie. Great, just a great human being. Tell me how that transpired. Well, you're 22, 23 years old?
Yeah, 23.
Wow.
23
okay,
years
so
old.
23 years old, yep. Go to work for Charlie right here in Homewood, the same office or same place. Okay, so you're working for the – what did you start out doing?
Yeah, so I came in as a entry-level financial advisor. Mm-hmm. I had to start out with training. There's a lot of tests and licenses that you have to go through. So I really spent the first year eating with Kim every night losing weight because I wasn't eating as good as I was used
to. That's
right. trying to invest in my business. And that's just like Charlie told me, if I wanted to be an owner of that business, then that was my investment, is in those first years spending a lot of time learning and understanding how to go out and serve people and how to be successful in this business by helping others.
Were they teaching you, were you trying to learn the nuts and the bolts of the financial business, the stock market, or were you trying to learn the nuts and the bolts of sales / relationship? What was his theory?
If I'm honest with you, it was the latter. I was learning finance.
Yeah, sure.
And then it took me getting into the third or fourth year before I really began to realize that there is an art behind serving others and where my focus needed to be. I needed to move it less and less from the nuts and bolts of finance, outsource that to professionals that's their only job, and really begin to focus on my clients. What do they need? What do they want? What are we trying to help them accomplish?
So in that, when he brings you in, what does he pay you, a salary?
Yeah, I wish today we have plans like that to help people transition. But when I started, no, it was a full entrepreneurial role.
So no salary. It was all commission.
Correct.
So what'd you make the first year?
So the first 6 months, I had made less than $9,000. The second 6 months, I got better. Mm-hmm. And so for the first year, I probably made around $30,000, maybe.
Around $30,000.
Maybe, yeah.
So learning this, doing this, tell me about the path. So this is 1997, 98, 99-ish?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're
it's
getting
7,
out.
8, 97, 98.
97, 98. So I get there in 98, you're transitioning out. So you start doing this and start learning. So tell me, just go through the path. Go through the path of like being at Nylon and what that looks like.
Yeah. So the best learning. So every Monday morning we'd come together as a group and have a traditional sales meeting that you would think about. Hey, how many people were you able to talk to? How many people did you help? What did that look like? Then it would be followed up by a training session, and we would have different professionals that would come in from the office to talk about specific services.
What office? From that?
From Nallen and Associates.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yep. Sometimes it would leverage to outside partnerships we had, but for the most part, it was all in-house. The best learning that ever happened for me, and you'll appreciate this, I began to realize, hey, I need to bring in some people that really know what they're doing, that are on the team, because I'm able to get appointments with people, but I'm getting questions I don't know the answer to. So I'm not helping them and it's not helping me.
Yeah.
So I began to do joint work with some of the senior advisors that had been doing this 20 years that were in the office, bringing them in. And that's why the second 6 months of my first year, things really began to change. And I said, you know, there's something to this. I enjoy working as a team. It serves the client better. So I'll manage the relationship, and I'll leverage the expertise of these people that have more experience. But what I learned, Thomas, is that's where I learned, because I saw them.
You're sitting in the room.
I'm sitting in the room. Yeah.
And then after you hear it four times, you can then explain it to Susie and Johnny.
Exactly. 100%.
Okay.
That teamwork approach.
So you bring these guys in. When did you start making more money? I mean, obviously you make more money as you go. When did you start really doing what you would consider well in this financial industry?
Well, my second year built a lot of momentum, a whole lot of momentum. So it was much different than year one. And really in my third year, things took off. And we began to really see. And it was very similar. Here's what Charlie told me that first day. He said, Justin, this business is great for the right person, and it's terrible for the wrong person. He said, if you enjoy talking to people, building relationships, and solving problems, he said, over time, this is going to be a great business. Your first couple of years, you're going to have to invest and learn how to solve problems, learn how to build this business. He said, but about year three, you're going to see things really begin to change for you and how you serve clients. And he was dead on. Year three was the year that things really began to take off in our business.
I think I know the answer to this, but why did it take off in year three? What was magical about year three that he said, but you also saw?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things, really. So if I'm honest with you, my confidence in year three was so different than year one. And because I had sat in those meetings and realized that, hey, I now understand how to sit down mm-hmm. with a client that's 50-55 that yeah. owns a business and has tax questions and has investment goals. I now understand better how to sit down with them and solve those problems. So the confidence was a big factor, but yeah. also the momentum of having some success under my belt for year one and year two. There's when you're an owner, Thomas, there is momentum that takes place in the business cycle yeah. that you go through. And so being able to take advantage of that momentum and plug into the relationships that were in that industry and in our office really, really began to take off. And then other people began to ask me to come in and help them, where before I was the one asking others.
What were they asking you to do, though? So give me an example of the first couple of times that someone said, hey, Justin, can you come help me with this? What was this? What were you helping them with?
Well, I've had a saying, Thomas, for over 20 years that, you know, hope is great in our faith and we depend on it, but hope is a horrible financial strategy.
Mm.
What I mean by that is, man, I hope my investments go up. Mm-hmm. I hope I don't lose money. I hope I have enough to retire on.
Wow.
So I want to build certainty in financial plans. You can't give it totally.
No.
But I want to build a level of confidence and certainty. And to do that, you've got to have a strategy. And so people begin to bring me in to help them assemble and put together those strategies that help build certainty for their clients to get from A to B.
Okay, so as a financial advisor, talk to me about this, because I know certain people in this industry, and they don't pick stocks, and they don't pick that stuff. Were you picking the stocks and picking, hey, buy Apple, buy, you know, GE, were you picking them, or were you just saying, we need to be in, just tell me about what you were doing other than meeting with people and getting them plugged into the strategy that you've set up.
Yeah.
What were you doing from a tactical standpoint?
Well, if I can be honest with you, Thomas, early on I did.
You did?
And I thought I was really, really good at it.
Yeah.
So think about the years. And for those that are listening, you can go back and look.
Oh, yeah.
So 98, 99.
Oh, killing it.
Two of the best years there were. So it didn't matter what I picked. But I would. We had research that we had access to.
Sure.
So I would sit down like I did in college with the stock market game. And I'd look at, you know, PE ratios and just basic things. And I'd say, this is a good stock to buy. here's our strategy. You need a certain amount of growth, a certain amount of value, certain amount of bonds. So I'd put together what we call an asset allocation. That's simply just how you divide your money.
Okay.
And I would then go out to do the research and pick those investments. So 98, 99, I thought I was really, really good.
Yeah, everybody did.
My head wouldn't fit through the door.
Wow.
Then 2000 came along, and things certainly changed a lot, especially in 01.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I reevaluated and realized that I need, just like I had partnered with people in our firm and took advantage of that expertise to learn, at this point, I need to partner with people that are doing that full time.
All
because
time.
I was not doing that full time.
Yeah. I've heard that said that there are people that manage the relationships and manage the people, and they know exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
But there's not enough hours in the day to analyze the market, analyze the, like I said, PE ratios and the value, all those things, and still love clients, serve clients,
yeah,
understand what they need. How many advisors out there, and you can speak generally because I know you know the industry, how many advisors out there do both? How many manage the relationships, taking the telephone calls from Thomas,
yeah,
but then are also picking the stocks, picking the mutual funds, picking the ETF, whatever?
Right.
How many are doing both?
You're seeing less and less of that today.
Okay.
But some of the older advisors, I would tell you, it would surprise you more than you would think.
They're still doing it.
Yeah. Yep. That have been doing it a while.
So the theory now is to, Justin, let's just use Justin for example. Justin will manage Thomas, talk to Susie, talk to whoever, and understand what's going on, where their assets are allocated.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a guy somewhere else, either in the office or somebody that y'all lean on, that picks those stocks and picks those and moves the money amounts and buys and sells and different things like that. Is that correct?
Yeah. So look at it this way, Thomas. You're a quarterback.
Yep.
So in our role, we want to be the best quarterback we can be, which means distributing the ball where it needs to go, depending on where we are in the game, right? Okay. So if it's fourth quarter and you're down a couple of touchdowns, you got to go deep a little more.
Right.
However, if you've got a lead, you follow me?
Sure.
And it's early in the third quarter, you're the quarterback, you want to get it to that good running back, or you want to throw it out in the flat. What that means is you want to be more conservative. So that goes back to my whole point. Have a strategy. Know where you are, what season of life you're in, so that you can understand the game is the game.
Yeah.
But what we want to do is help put the odds in your favor as much as we can, because there are no guarantees, but we want to be sure we understand all the variables that could impact you and have the appropriate strategy.
Yeah. The thing I want people to understand about financial advisors and what you guys do is you have a fiduciary responsibility, which everybody knows that means you have my best interest at heart. You just shouldn't take your own interest, whatever. But the bottom line is this, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you manage all my money, you make more money when I make more money.
Sure.
So you want us to be as progressive and as wealthy as possible, because if you increase our value, you make more money.
Sure. That's the whole...
That's the bottom line of the whole thing. And I want people to get... because there are some bad stigmas about the financial industry.
Yeah.
I don't totally... But I understand the industry. But tell me about how... Do you ever battle that today? Do you battle that? Like, do you ever have people that you don't know, that don't know you, that speak negatively of the financial industry?
You know, if I do, I don't know about it.
Sure.
You know, at this point, most of the clients I work with know who we are, know who I am. And I work mostly on a referral basis. But from an industry standpoint, Thomas, there is certainly a stigma. And let me be honest. I don't care where you go or what you do in the restaurant industry, in the food industry, there are bad apples, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
So there are some people that are not bringing the level of service they should in our industry. But here's what I would say to your viewers out there and listeners. Number one, find someone that you trust.
Yeah.
Find someone you can ask a question to.
Yeah.
All right. And feel comfortable about it. If you're nervous, if they make you feel less than thou, when you ask the question, that's a red flag, okay? Find somebody you trust, you can talk to, that you can ask a question of, and then just go meet with two or three.
Yeah.
And find who you just feel comfortable with. If you can do that, then there are a lot of good people out there. There's a lot of good people in this industry, and I think that's important.
Tell me about how it progresses from there. So you're 4 or 5 years into this thing.
Yeah.
What's the growth look like? Not from a financial standpoint, but like more responsibility, more this. People are asking you to do things for them. Take me along the path a little bit.
Yeah, man. I'm not sure that I was exactly qualified, but Charlie came to me and said, "Would you like to take over our training program?" And I was about 5 years in to the business, man. So I began to do our training sessions, and through that, it was a great opportunity. Anytime you get put in leadership, then you're forced to grow.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's uncomfortable, but I know I've heard you say this on here before. Growth takes place when you're uncomfortable.
Has to.
So you've got to get out of your comfort zone, even a little bit. And whatever you're doing today, don't be afraid to push yourself. Don't be afraid to take that next step that gets you a little uncomfortable, because that's where growth happens. And for me, I'm so thankful he pushed me to do that. Yeah. So for the next few years, took over the training program. We implemented some unique ideas that we use today that have really helped us from a growth standpoint, but more importantly, has helped us serve clients better.
Yeah.
And that's where I met another mentor name you hear me talk about a lot, which is a gentleman named Nelson Nash, who was an economist. Met him in 2007.
Okay.
And it really changed the paradigm of our industry. And we actually took a business model that at the time was about 35 years old and completely revamped it and changed it and began to implement teaching that showed our clients actually how money really flows.
Right.
So they could understand money and how to create, again, I go back to this word, ownership for themselves.
Yeah. Okay, so what was Mr. Nallen, what was Mr. Nallen's and Nelson's relationship like? Were they buddies? Did they know each other?
They did not know each other.
Highly unusual. How did you meet Nelson then?
So I got invited to, I'll make a long story short, I got invited to a conference in Orlando.
Okay.
There were about 40 really senior financial advisors. I was by far the youngest guy in the room. I'm amazed that I got invited. It was humbled to be there.
You?
So it was a funny story. Is a gentleman that is out of Kansas who had been in this industry for years, who had worked with a couple of families at the time on the Forbes 400 list.
Oh, wow.
And he invited me. We had met at some industry functions. He said, "You really need to go to this." So it was an honor. I flew down, and Nelson Nash was the keynote speaker in January of 2007.
So you go to this conference. There's only 40 people in the room, Justin?
Mm-hmm. About that,
wow.
Give or take.
Pretty elite group, it sounds like.
There were some really, really great people in that room, in our industry, yeah.
So Nelson Nash, so I'm going to butcher this. I hope I don't butcher this. So Nelson Nash is the father of the infinite banking concept, IBC, so many different things. And the amount of knowledge that I've learned from you and the books you've given me and the talks of like the scratch. I mean, I can't tell you pieces of scratch paper we've went through talking about infinite banking and what that is. So you hear him. Is he talking about infinite banking in Orlando at this thing? What did he talk about?
Yeah, so he ended a little bit with his book. The book is called Becoming Your Own Banker.
Yep.
It's in like 30 countries.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a bestseller.
Wonderful book.
Yeah, really short. He talked about that at the end, but in the very beginning, actually what he was talking about, he says this all the time, is the economics of you and me, meaning how to bring down the economy and the problems the economy has, how to look at that at the you and me level.
Okay.
And begin to protect ourselves and our businesses and our future with action that we can take. Because here's the problem, and I'm guilty of this, and I know some of the people out there are. You hear the news and you hear these numbers. Hey, we're 33 trillion in debt as a country, and we're a trillion and a half, you know, in running in deficits on our annual budgets, and this, and it begins to not really make sense. You're
sure.
Like, those are just big numbers. I mean, it makes you can't relate to it. So he brought the problem down to the you and me level. But help me understand that. But then he began to say, the good news is there are solutions, and the solutions have been around for over 100 years. So how do you look at the problem, and then how do you find the solution to use things that are already there just a little bit differently than they had been used before?
So you meet Nelson at this. How old is Nelson at the time? This is 2007. He's pretty old.
Yeah, I mean, he's already in his late 70s.
Okay, so you meet Nelson at this thing. What did you go up to him and talk to him and say, hey, yeah, what happened? Tell me that.
I wish, man. I wish I could tell you that. Yeah. So in his book, he has a very small chapter called The Arrival Syndrome, where he talks about people that really just think that they have it all figured out. Mm. He makes a statement. He says, 5% of the people in this country think, 10% of the people think they think, the other 85% would rather die than think. Mm. And I want you to think about that for a minute.
Say that again.
So he said, 5% of people think for themselves, 10% think they think, the other 85% would rather die than think. What he meant by that, if you think about it and process that, is we just get so ingrained. Hey, we wake up, we eat breakfast, we go to work, we come home, we turn on, these are his words, the idiot box. We see what the news is telling us. That impacts how we should think. That we see the commercials. That impacts how we buy, where we put our money, what we do with it. Then we go back to bed and we do it all again. Mm. He said very few people are thinking. And if I'm honest with you, Thomas, I fell into that arrival syndrome because I heard him talking. I'm like, you know, we got a growing business. We're doing pretty well. We got things figured out. What a cool guy. That's what I was like, man, what a nice old man. He was like my grandfather. But I did not read his book, and I did not go up and meet him after the conference, and I'm ashamed to say that.
Yeah.
So what happened is a few months later, the guy that invited me called me, and he said, hey, did you read that book yet? I said, no, I didn't read it, but hey, it's pretty cool. Thanks for inviting me. He said, here's the deal. If you don't read that book this week, I'm going to call you. If you don't read it this week, you're not coming back next year.
Holy crap.
Yeah, and I said, what? Really?
Now, this guy in Kansas, what was the guy in Kansas' name? Do you mind me telling?
We'll probably
name him John.
Yeah.
John in Kansas. John in Kansas invites you to this thing. He says, if you don't read this, was he into IBC at
the time? He was.
Okay. Did he know Nelson?
He did.
So he knew Nelson,
yep.
Which is probably the reason he invited you.
Maybe so.
So he knew Nelson. He saw something in you, and he kind of put his thumb on you and said, hey, bro,
yep.
Read the book or you're not coming back next year. What
yep.
did you do?
Yep. So I actually took it as a challenge. So I read the book. When I read it, I'm like, wow, it really challenged me. But there were some things that I had questions on.
Well, let's go back. The book he's talking about is Nelson Nash's book, Becoming Your Own Banker.
Correct.
It's at Amazon. It's at all the places. Okay, yep. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yep. So that's the book. So I read the book, had some questions, but it did challenge me. So I called him, said, hey, I read the book. He said, good for you. I asked him a couple of questions. He goes, well, why don't you ask the guy that wrote it? He lives in your hometown.
He does.
I was like, really? He said, look on
the back of the book.
I gave
him. I know. I saw that.
Had his address on it. He was 3 miles down the road from our office, called Nelson, invited him in. And that was the beginning of a great relationship.
Okay. Tell me about you and Nelson, because I've heard you talk about a handful of people over and over again in our meetings. So I meet with Justin once or twice a month. I'm a client of him and his company, but also I consider him a valuable friend of mine. And I ask him all the time, hey, when can we meet? And reluctantly, he says yes, and I give him lots of coffee, and we have a great time. So you talk about a handful of people that are incredibly important. We've talked about John Neal.
Yep.
We've talked about Charlie Nellen. The third person that you constantly mention is Nelson Nash.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about, thanks for the goodness, the guy from Kansas, John in Kansas, got on your butt about meeting Nelson. So yep. You meet Nelson Nash. Tell me about that relationship.
Yeah, so Nelson came in, and for years I actually had the yellow pad. So as he walked in, got to meet him, and my whole objective was to get answers to my questions mm-hmm. right away. You know, here's my questions. He's not a right away kind of guy. Mm. So remember, Nelson's 77, 78 at the time when I meet him. And he's like a grandfather. He's a storyteller. So you'll ask a question. He said, Justin, let me tell you a story. And he'll start talking about his time as he was a forester. Yeah. He would start telling you about his forestry dealings in North Carolina in the 50s and planting trees and when do you harvest and how is it renewable and just on and on and on. But when you get to the end of the story, what was amazing about him, and I wish I could do it, Thomas, I had discovered the answer for myself through his story and the questions he would ask me. And he was a master at that.
Yeah.
He was able to get you to think. And he would tell you, that is always my goal. It's easy to give you the answer, but I want you to own the answer, because only then will you know it and it be part of who you are each and every day. So through that first conversation, I still have the yellow pad where I was trying to prove him wrong. I invited him back again. He came graciously, and just like you feeding me coffee, that's all we had to do. He had his own coffee cup in our office. He would go in and get it, and the ladies would make his coffee. We started meeting every Monday morning about
the
between
team
9
just
and
you.
At that time, just me.
Okay.
And later on, I introduced him to the team. So in 2008,
okay.
So remember, we took the first 6 months, I did nothing with it. The next 6 months was me trying to understand it and then putting it in practice. So I'm the first one, okay. because I will not represent something to someone if I'm not doing it myself.
Absolutely.
And so I did the very first infinite banking concept strategy that was done in our office. I did it in late 2007.
Okay.
Wanted to see how it worked.
Sure.
Then from there, I utilized the second piece to that strategy. Then we began to roll it out to clients and share with them this story. And I had some really trusted clients who were like, "Justin, I've been waiting on this for years. Thank you for sharing it."
Really?
So the concept really took off quickly, and people were excited to embrace it. And so we began to revamp our entire process. It's not something, and I tell people this all the time, the infinite banking concept is not something that everyone's going to do, but the understanding of how money flows is something everyone should understand, because right. it will only make you better.
So this relationship with Nelson grew 2007, 2008. When did Nelson pass away?
So Nelson passed away, I believe it was 2018.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had a long relationship with him.
He came almost every Monday. And there were several times he stopped driving toward the end.
Yeah.
One of the biggest blessings of my life, he actually got an award up in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And so I actually drove him to Atlanta. We got caught in a traffic jam. He was late for getting his award, because imagine Atlanta.
Yeah, Atlanta.
I mean, I took 4 hours and we still were late. But to this day, I wrote about it in my journal. We had the best conversation about faith. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd have had a tape recorder, yeah. because he began to tell me how everything in the life of Jesus, how the crucifixion all came from money and people's love of money and not understanding it from an abundance standpoint, but from a scarcity standpoint. Think about what happened during the Holy Week when he went into the temple. What did he do?
Turned over the tables.
Turned over the tables, yeah. and said, this is not a market.
Right.
This is the house of my Father. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. And he talked about if they had just understood how to think abundantly, and if they had put a system together for themselves as the Pharisees, as opposed to being transactional oriented and trying to get as much as they can, had they built a system that they could own and control, think about how much better off they would have been. And Jesus understood that.
Yeah.
It goes all the way back to the principles of Joseph in Genesis. How do you store up in a warehouse in times of abundance and then utilize that money when opportunities present themselves so that you can create more abundance to do what? Not only for yourself, but so you can serve others, and it perpetuates itself. And I'm trying to go real fast, that was the mission of Nelson Nash. He wanted to create an abundance mindset, an ownership mindset, so that people could create a system so they could grow their wealth, protect their wealth, so that they could do more with it.
Okay, talking about infinite banking concept, I would be remiss if I did not bring this up. So it's kind of like Democrats and Republicans.
Where are you going here?
Okay, you got really, really staunch people that are really headstrong Democrats, and you got really, really staunch people that are Republicans, and then you got people in the middle that don't give two flying craps about either.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a group of people out there that thinks that IBC, infinite banking, is the best thing since sliced bread. I'm one of those people. And then you got a group of people out there that thinks it's the devil's potion.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we talk about IBC or infinite banking, okay, Give me the 45 second version of what is IBC.
Before we hit what is, one thing to really, really understand about it is that this is not a product to be sold. It is a process. And that is on the first page of Nelson's book.
Yeah.
This is a process for you to understand money and build an economy within your family and in your circle that you own, that you control.
Yeah.
And that is the whole idea behind it. And that's why that whole book is based around ownership. Okay. So to get outside of that, what is infinite banking? It is literally nothing more than a pool of capital, a place to warehouse your savings, that you own it and control it, and you can utilize that in one of two ways, either to pay off liabilities you have or to increase assets that you have.
Okay.
And it goes back to one simple premise, and everybody hear this. There's a cost to everything you and I do. Here's what I mean by that. You're either going to go buy a car and you're going to pay interest for using someone else's money,
right,
i.e. the bank, or you're going to give up interest you could have earned by paying cash, meaning you're going to take money from a CD, a savings account, a money market, a mutual fund, or a stock. You're going to take money from somewhere that was earning interest, and you're going to pay cash.
Yeah.
So people don't think about this, but either way you go, there's a cost. You're either paying interest or you're losing interest you could have earned.
Correct.
So what Nelson wants to do is show you a system where you can recapture a portion of that interest you were paying or a portion of the interest you're losing, put it in your own pocket, and your pocket then grows by definition. And then we're then it becomes, okay, where do you put it?
Yeah.
So that's where people, unfortunately, have the arguments. Okay, where do you put it?
Sure.
But the concept itself is identifying there's a cost, creating a system to recapture that, so that your wealth, your pocket now grows by definition. That is as simple and fundamental as you can make it. And I think you and I would both agree, if you were paying interest to a bank and I could show you how you could put some of that interest in your pocket over the course of your lifetime, how much better off would you be?
Yeah, and you would do it.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got IBC, infinite banking concept, which is run through whole life insurance policies, correct?
Yep. So at some point, that wealth has to reside somewhere.
Correct.
We talked about Joseph. Where did he build it up? He built the stalls and said, we're going to store the wheat and the food there. All right. So we have to have a warehouse.
A warehouse meaning a place to hold it.
A place to hold it.
Yeah.
Where is your money residing?
Yep.
So there's only a few places. There's three places you can park money: in a taxable account,
okay,
which is a CD, a savings account, a mutual fund. You can park it in a tax-deferred account.
When you talk about a taxable account, when the money grows, you are taxed on the money that grows. Put $100,000 in, you make $10,000 of interest. You're taxed on the $100,000. You're taxed on the $10,000.
That's right.
All right.
Yep, great point. So the second place is what we call tax-deferred accounts.
Okay.
So these are places where you put a dollar, you don't pay tax on it, but when it grows, but when you pull it out, you pay tax on whatever income bracket. That's an IRA, that's a 401k, it could be real estate.
Sure.
It could even be business equity if you're a business owner. So it's deferred to the future. Then the third place is what we call tax-free. So Roth IRAs are the number one place people think of when they think of tax-free. So that's after-tax dollars that you can put in, and then you never have to pay tax on it again.
Okay.
So those are Roth IRAs, and then when you design it properly, life insurance. So specially designed, properly designed life insurance. Basically, all that means is not the traditional way. Most of the time, people think of life insurance for what reason?
So if in case you die, everybody gets paid.
Yeah, everybody. Yep, death benefit. It protects you, right? So you want to get as much death benefit as you can for as little money as possible. At that point in time, life insurance is an expense.
Sure.
And we're taught to minimize expenses. So here's what most people would tell you, and they're not wrong. Some of the people that you get their books and you see them on television and advertising on the radio, the financial geniuses, they will tell you life insurance is a bad place to park money. Life insurance is not a good investment. And here's the truth. They're right. Mm-hmm. If you buy it for death benefit, they're exactly right.
It's not good.
It's not good. So they're telling you the right thing. What Nelson showed me that I didn't know, and what a lot of people in our industry, it's catching on, but what a lot of people don't know is that you can design it in a different way. Instead of solving for that death benefit number, you can actually solve it to build up capital.
Yeah.
And minimize the death benefit. So think about this, and just kind of go with it for a second. If you're maximizing the capital that you have in a policy and minimizing the death benefit, and it's set up to grow every day, every week, every month, every year, it has now become an asset.
Yeah.
So we want to minimize expenses, but Thomas, what do we want to do to assets?
Make them grow.
We want to make them grow. We want to get as many assets as we can.
Right.
And that was the difference in Nelson's teaching, and that's what he showed us how to do, is that a life insurance policy can give you more of the characteristics that you want in a system that you own and control than any other type of instrument.
Right.
A taxable instrument, if it's a CD, this banking concept works if you want to do it with a money market or a savings account. I can show you the math right now, and it will work for you, and you will be better off utilizing it. However, you're going to pay tax on every dollar you earn. So every single year. So if we can do the same thing, but put it in a place where you don't have to pay tax on it when it's structured properly, then you're better off, right?
Right.
If you're in a 30% tax bracket, I just increased the rate of your savings by 30%, right?
Mm.
Think about that.
One of the things you told me when I was learning this, and I'll never forget this, and you looked at me and you said, hey, if you are going to get whole life insurance just for the death benefit, it is not for you. But the way that you can maximize whole life insurance is to take the capital that is built when you are building the policy, take that capital and use it to make more money, create more assets. Great example. When you have a whole life insurance, when you properly design it, you have a death benefit, but you also have cash value. So what I do, I'm fixing to take $92,000. This is a true story. I'm fixing to take $92,000 out of that policy. Okay. I'm going to borrow that money.
Yep.
And then I'm going to give it to a guy. And I have a term with this guy. It's a 9-month term. And I'm going to make 14% on my money. I will then take that 14% that I make and I will, quote, pay back that loan into my policy.
To the insurance company. Yep.
I will pay it back. So, but the whole time that I pull that money out, my insurance, the cash value is continuing to grow. I do have to pay a little interest on the money that I borrowed, but it far out, the 14% far outweighs. So I'm making the money in the policy. I'm making the money on the investment. And I got a little bit of a interest I have to pay, but I'm using the money in my cash value to make more money. People don't under, because if you're just buying it for the death benefit, it's not useful.
Yep.
But I have to take the cash value that I have built up, the warehouse, pull the money out of the warehouse that I've built, take that money, utilize it in a multiplicity of ways. And at that point, that's where I can create wealth.
So let me ask you a couple of questions on that. So when you pull the money out, and you, I know you've done this in the past, do you, did you get a 1099 for that?
I did not.
The interest you earned, did you have to pay any tax on that? Okay. Who controlled how they paid the money back?
I do.
You do?
Yeah.
Yep. So you're 100% in control.
Mm-hmm.
Did you take any risk on that money, or was it growing for you every day, every week,
it
every
grew,
month?
It grew in the policy. It grew in the policy the whole time.
Yep. So I tell people this all the time. If we could teach you a way to grow your wealth that was guaranteed not to go down in value, which I can't say the word guarantee unless I talk about a contract like this in the investment world, guaranteed to grow for you, where you had total control, you had no risk, and you never had to pay tax on it. Would you
sign?
Would you want to learn about it? I don't want you to sign up, but I want you to take ownership and learn about it.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, Thomas, you talked about those that are on the far right and the far left. There are a lot of people out there today that have seen this concept and heard the story you just told that we tell, and they're like, you know what? If I could package this just a little bit differently, I could sell the heck out of this to a lot of people. And so, unfortunately, we talked about it everywhere. There's a few bad apples. There's a ton of YouTube videos out there. And I'm going to tell you, some of them are really, really good.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people I know, and there's some really good people out there that knew Nelson and are doing this the right way. But unfortunately, there's also some people that have said, hey, I see now that we could take this story. And unfortunately, what did I say in the beginning? They can sell a lot of products.
Yeah.
This is not about a product. This is a process. So make sure who you're talking to, that you get the right answers and that it is built like the book Becoming Your Own Banker, because those are the ways that you can utilize this concept. And I tell people this all the time. It is not get rich quick.
No.
This is a process to give you control and teach you how to be an owner. And anybody that owns a business will tell you it takes time.
It takes time.
It takes time. And that's what this is.
In the beginning, and here's the thing too, when you train, when you lift weights, when I lift, I tear the muscles that I lift. And in essence, I've gone backwards a little bit. But what happens is when I tear, they grow back stronger. And then I take a step back, I grow back stronger. It's the same kind of somewhat of a concept with this is in the beginning, you kind of take a step, you take a step back, but then you grow.
Yep.
And then you continue to grow. And then you continue to grow.
Yep.
So talk about, so we've talked about infinite banking a bunch. We've talked about the financial. Where are you at in your business now?
Yeah.
Now on Associates, tell me about the transition, because Mr. Charlie came to you and said, hey, you want to do more? Tell me about that.
What was great, in 08, I had the chance to become a partner in the firm. It was a huge honor. In 2014, I became the managing partner and president. And then we began a few years later a process of transitioning the business. Charlie's now 81 years old. Yeah. Just a super guy, still walks on the treadmill and, and the Stairmaster and plays golf and comes into the office every day. And I
he does come in every day still.
Oh, yeah, every day, every day, every morning, and just about it. And I rely on him heavily. So he's a big part of the firm, and his name will always be on the door. So right now we're in a position to where, Thomas, what I really love seeing is I love seeing people grow. I love seeing other people take ownership in their business. And so we have, we've been growing a lot in the last few years in bringing people in, plugging them into what Nelson has taught us, how it impacts others. We've started measuring things totally differently. We now measure our business on how many people we serve every year. How many people, I call it impact. How many people are we impacting as a firm each and every year? And that's the only number I'm worried about. The rest of it's going to take care of itself.
How many people that you guys serve are just IBC or just finance? You got, so you got three groups out there. You got just IBC, you got just finances, and then you got a mix of both. What's the breakdown there? Do you know?
Yeah, I have a general idea.
Yeah, general,
I don't know the exact number. But
sure.
so we have two divisions. So IBC is more on the insurance side.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have our wealth management practice where we manage about $800 million in assets for people in a fiduciary capacity. Many of them, because financial planning involves multiple products and services. So many of them, it's a combination of both. Some may enter and need help with a rollover, or they're retiring, and they may enter there, and then, you know, we'll implement an IBC strategy for them or for their kids or their business, or some enter through the IBC and we realize you need some help over here. So there's a combination of the two. I would say the majority of them are there, a combination.
So transitioning through that, you've talked about hiring a lot of people, and I know, and we've talked about this with Jen Ryan on the previous episodes. We've talked about it with multiple people. You like hiring a particular person with a particular background.
You're and smiling.
I did not discuss this with him before this episode. Tell me, and I guess you got to be careful. I don't guess you got to be careful. You own the business. You can do what you want. Tell me the people that you tilt towards hiring.
Yeah, I will be, for a number of reasons. Former athletes have really, really shown a tendency to be successful in our industry.
Yeah.
And particularly,
why do you think that is?
Yeah. I think it's a number of reasons. And I mean, I could probably list 10 or 15 for you, but I'll just hit the top four or five. All right. So the first thing that I will tell you, former athletes, if you look at it and that transition into business ownership, It's a pretty high success ratio, much higher than the average. And here's the reason why, because they're used to dealing with adversity. Every one of us, whether it's in the game, in practice, or at, like I said, in that those winter workouts, we're used to adversity. We're used to someone in our ear, a coach, that may not be telling us what we want to hear every single day. And I find that to be extremely important, because if you're going to be an owner in a business, then you're going to have adversity. You're going to have some curveballs thrown at you. So the second thing is they know how to work in a team atmosphere.
Yeah.
All right. So they're used to lining up. If you're basketball, you got, you know, you got five players. I mean, if you're in football, you got 11. They're used to a team atmosphere, and they're used to working in a group for success. And that's a big part of our firm. Huge. We're not individual. More than 70% of our clients have two advisors. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of mentoring and a lot of what we call joint work so that the client is served better. Yeah. Because, Thomas, if we're sitting with a client, I may be doing the presentation, but you can hear something that maybe I'm not hearing or see something so that we can make sure we're getting that question answered. And that's so important. So I think they're good at working as a team.
Yeah.
Also, they have a tremendous work ethic. They've had to get up and manage time for 4 or 5 years, sometimes 6 nowadays, right, with the COVID years. So they're used to time management. They're used to hard work. They're used to having a schedule.
Yeah.
And that's what it takes, especially in the early years as a business owner. So, and then the final thing, a lot of them are really, really good. They've got a little bit of confidence built up, and so they're not afraid to share their ideas, share their conversations with others. And so if you put all those together, that's a really good mixture for being an entrepreneur and being an owner.
Tell me about now, you're on the business, you've got a wonderful, wonderful staff. From Stacy to the people that work with you, to the other advisors, all the different things. What are you working on now? What are you working on now at this stage in life?
Yeah, so a few things. You know, number one for me, and Thomas, I've told you this, I am so fired up, and I appreciate that you're having a podcast like this where we can say what's important to us.
Right.
I'm so fired up about people knowing who Jesus is to me.
Yeah.
And so 2024, I hope everyone will stay tuned because I am looking forward to sharing with people in different ways who Jesus is to me, but more importantly, who Jesus is in the business world.
Yeah.
I think there are so many men and women out there that want to bring Christ-centered service into the business world, but maybe they don't know how.
Yeah.
And I was one of those 7 or 8 years ago. So I'm looking forward to doing that, and that's what gets me fired up. The second thing that gets me fired up is I love seeing our team grow, and I love seeing people advance. So we're working on an organization chart right now, and elevating some of the people that really, really deserve it, and seeing them grow and build and enter into those training phases. So those things are important. And then the final thing for me, part of my three-legged investment stool, I've got IBC, I have obviously market type investments. And then for me, we've talked about this before, the third leg of that stool is businesses, real estate and small businesses in particular. So I'm really looking forward to evaluating in this next year different investment opportunities and growing my own horizon and growing in that, my knowledge level in that, particularly in the multifamily space. So those are the three areas I'm working on, but none of them trumps what I said first.
That's awesome. Okay, I don't want theoretical answers on this next question, okay?
Yeah, man.
I want something tactical. Got a guy coming out of college. Guy wants to be a business owner. What would you tell a young business owner this day and age?
Yep. First thing I would tell them to do, wherever you are, invest in yourself. Find the best people in that industry.
Okay.
And go talk to them. Go buy them coffee. Go buy them lunch. Go sit down and ask them. You know, if you're in a car dealership, go find the best sales guy and ask him, hey, what are you doing every day? I want to learn from you. Mm-hmm. If you're in a franchise business, find the people that are the best franchisees. If you're in real estate, go find the person that's been doing it.
Yeah.
And find out what they're doing. If you're a golf pro, go find the best professional at the best club. Take him to lunch. Whatever you're doing, go find the people that are the best at it and ask them what they're doing and what advice they would give you. Invest in yourself. Read more. I don't care what you're doing. Read more. Listen to, pick out a couple of really good podcasts. There's one here through Church of the Highlands about leadership that's as good as anything that I've ever heard. Plug those things in. Take those nuggets and invest in yourself. The best investment you can make early in your career is in you.
I told my wife this the other day. We got into a deep discussion on coaching. My wife's a volleyball coach, great volleyball coach, parenting.
Yep.
and just relationships in general. I looked at it, and for so many years as parents and so many years as business owners, we're taught to other people. The Bible is very specific about love God, love others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I looked at her and I said, hey, you are the most important person in your life. You have to make sure that you are as great as you can be at all the things that you're called to be.
Yeah.
A parent, a wife, a coach. You got to be great at those different things. Because if you're not great at those things, one of the other areas is going to lack. And the last thing we want to do is neglect one of the things that's most important. We can only have so many things in our life that are important.
Yep.
Okay. Jesus had 12 disciples. He really had three friends, three guys that were just like super close to him.
Yeah.
We can only have so many things. And what you're saying is extremely true and extremely important. We got to make sure that we are getting better every day, physically, mentally, spiritually, and honestly, socially. Mm-hmm. We got to make sure those relationships are right, because if we don't have those great relationships, the other areas can't be as good.
Yeah.
As we wrap up here, we talked about what you're focused on right now. One of the things, two of the questions I always like to ask everybody, one of them's kind of fun, one of them's I want to really think of. Other than the Bible, what's the best book you've ever read?
Yeah, so great question. The one that probably changed me the most and really impacted me was the book by Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Wow, okay.
No joke.
Yep,
it's a great book. I know there's a ton of other ones, but yeah, my mindset changed after reading that and really thinking about it. And I bought my first piece of real estate after reading that book.
Did you?
And it parlayed, and then I went and I read all of them, the cash flow quadrant,
all of them,
all the way through. Made a real, real big difference.
That's huge.
You know, obviously Nelson's book changed my mind financially, becoming your own banker. That was a good one. And then there's one that really not a lot of people talk about.
Yeah.
And it was God, the name escapes me, Thomas.
You're good. We'll stop it.
It'll come to me,
And
I'll come back. But it's the guy in the 30s, Think and Grow Rich.
Napoleon Hill.
All
right, go back. So transition out of do the whole thing again. Okay, so What is one of the questions I like to always ask everybody is, what is the, other than the Bible, what is your favorite book?
Yeah, so a couple of them come to mind.
Yeah.
The one that changed me the most was Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki.
Classic, wonderful book.
Yep.
Everybody should read it.
Made a huge impact for me as far as understanding ownership, going into the cash flow quadrant.
Yep.
Really changed my mentality. From there, obviously, Nelson's book, Becoming Your Own Banker, we talked about that, financially changed my life. And then one that not a lot of people talk about, but more CEOs, I think, have read this book than any other. That's Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Yeah. It was first written in the 30s. And really, really goes back to how we began our conversation today. How do you think abundantly versus scarcely? Yeah. Those three books, man, I would tell everybody that's going into business to read those.
Absolutely wonderful. Read all three. They're great. What's the favorite? This is a fun question. What's the favorite vacation? You're a traveler. What's the favorite vacation you've ever taken?
Man, we just took the best trip I've ever taken in my life. We went to Scotland.
Yep.
I got to play the Old Course. You might can. Might
I saw
see
it.
That.
I see it. We got a big golfer here. He's a huge golfer. So
that was a dream. I actually wrote it down, Thomas, when I graduated college. I wrote 10 things down. Terrible goals. I wish I could have redone them. But one of those on that list was to play the Old Course. So I got to check that off. From there, Kim's dream, which I'm so glad we did it because I was like, it's okay.
Yeah.
But her dream had always been to go to Italy. Her family was from Italy. Yeah. So we went to the Amalfi Coast, and it's the most beautiful place I've ever seen in my life. We stayed a week, and I'm telling you, it was unbelievable.
Wow.
Absolutely unbelievable.
I've never even heard of that coast, so I have to check it out.
Check it out. Yeah. Google it.
Last question. What is your favorite vacation that you've never taken?
Israel.
Perfect.
Yep. That's where I've always wanted to go.
Yeah.
I had a goal to try to do that in this coming year. We'll see how that plays out. But yeah,
push that one back a little bit.
We might have to. But yeah, I've always wanted to go to the Holy Land, walk where Jesus walked.
That's perfect. If someone wanted to get in contact with you because they love your energy, they want to have you to come speak, whatever. There's so many different things that you can are qualified to do. Where can someone find you?
NalinWM.com. Nalin Wealth Management is what that stands for, .com.
Okay.
Be great. And then we have another site that has got a ton of videos and information. It's called UnlimitWealth.com.
UnlimitWealth.com. Mm-hmm. NalinWM.com and UnlimitWealth. So awesome. Justin, you've been great. Thank you so much. Please, if you have any questions, Justin is a wealth of knowledge, and as much as anything, his team is outstanding.
Thank you.
All of your guys, all of your girls, it's a testament to who you are as a leader and as a man that you build those guys up and those girls up and let them do their job, and they're so good at it. And here's the thing, too. They love you. And for having that many people that love you and respect you and love working with you, that's a testament to who you are. And I really, really appreciate you. I appreciate you for who you are to me and the difference you've made in my life just in the last year or two. I really, really appreciate you. And I thank you so much for coming on here, because I know that people seeing this is going to benefit them in so many ways. So thank you.
It's been a lot of fun today, man. I love it. Thank you.
Thanks.